are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
We are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
It kind of looked like Greenland on acid is kind of what it looked like.
We are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Expecting him to be 15-15, he's got to hit 15 home runs.
We are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another FWFB, Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast. We're in the 240s for our episode number. We got the preview for our brand new logo, our new emblem, which is coming out just in time for us to need to buy more stuff after we bought the new stuff that we just got a few weeks ago. Did you see the new emblem today there, Evan?
It looks fantastic, and nothing against the original Rona shirts that we had. That was pretty clean as well. This is a very good set for FWFB, and we're just going to be all kinds of balling. I know we're on the lookout for new podcast music, so if you happen to jam, be sure to send that our way. But I love the new logo. I don't know about you.
No, I like the new logo. The old logo was okay, but it kind of looked like Greenland on acid. Is kind of what it looked like. I don't know if you agree with me or not, but it looked kind of funky, and it didn't always jive right with certain colors with the shirts and the wear in general. So I'm pretty excited about it as well. Although I don't think my wife will be excited about me, dropping another couple hundred dollars on gear if that's what happens here in the next few weeks. Uh-huh. Anyway, we had a couple different things going on. As far as the chat room was concerned, and I want to speak to that. Unfortunately, Ben had a big delay at work today, so he won't be able to join us. But as well as that, we're going to cover today some bold predictions that Evan and I have for the upcoming season. They're directly correlated to fantasy results and some players that we haven't spoken all that extensively about yet to this point. So, Evan, why don't you... Mr. Evan Peterson, why don't you announce how you can be reached so we get the logistics out of the way here?
Yeah, absolutely. At EasyEv3, punctual, on time, show up when I'm supposed to be. No, I'm just kidding. It sucks that Ben had to work, but life gets in the way of this little game that we play called fantasy baseball, so I won't give him too much hassle. You can find me on Twitter harassing Tejal Bedick from Razzball about why he hates Kendrick Lamar, and I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, then. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. And in one of my more major gaffes yet as a member of Friends with Fantasy Benefits, I forgot to mark down that we had a stoppage in our last show that I edited with Ian Perez. And so we talked right through it. I mean, it was like a live thing. That's what it was. It was live. It was behind the scenes within the scenes. That's the way I'm going to try and look at it, because I'm certainly not going to make that mistake again. Well, anyway, we have kind of a little topic to speak about first, and that's going to be talking about some of these preseason injuries. The one thing we haven't really talked about is that when preseason injuries happen, more often than not, these players are not put on the DL. So there's very little that you can do with them. And other people, if they have dead weight on their roster, can sort of drop other players and pick players up that may be filling in for the player that you've lost. I, of course, have the nicety of having drafted, Mr. The second baseman from the Cleveland Indians, coming off his red hot year last year. And his name escapes me, but
Jason Kipnis.
Jason Kipnis. Yeah, I was thinking Kinsler, so I was right there. So anyway, Kipnis and in two of my first three leagues that I drafted, and then drafting Ian Desmond in the third league, We weren't even done with the draft when he got hurt and broke his hand. So if you had this happen to you a lot in the past, and you agree with me that these preseason injuries are far worse than regular season injuries?
I agree that they're a lot more damaging, especially it's one thing kind of like in the Michael Brantley mold of last year when you knew that there were going to be issues going into the season and you could kind of bake that into draft price. But it's a completely different thing when you're expecting a guy to be healthy and you take him at cost. You know, you take Jason Kipnis, who I recently drafted in the FWFB Staff League, and I got him at a decent price. It was about 95th overall in the draft, and I backed him up really well, so it's not going to hurt me too much. But I could see, had I not gone that route in a deep 16-team league and, you know, thought, well, I got Jason Kipnis, and I'm solid as I'm going to be. And, I mean, it would put me in a real bad spot, and it only benefits – you know, some of these other guys, like you were saying, Jose Ramirez, I think, is going to pick up second base eligibility was what somebody was trying to tell me today. So it leaves you hamstrung at draft time because you go, well, maybe I'd want Jose Ramirez at that draft price, but nothing you can do now. Just play it out. And, you know, hopefully there's some good in the card still.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is the larger the league you're in, the more mentally debilitating it is, because you realize that it's going to be very, very difficult to replace any lengthy absences of at bats. In one of the leagues that I have Ian Desmond in, my first hitter off the bench, and in a 15-team NFBC league, I didn't think this was too bad, was Martin Prado, who now, of course, is also going on the DL. I'm not going to start the season. So one of my longtime friends in fantasy baseball always used to tell me, any injury that you think is going to affect a guy the first couple weeks of the season or more takes a guy's draft value down 50 spots in the draft. Does that seem about right to you?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, solid 3 to 4 rounds. And depending on if you like the guy, you may not be willing to go the full 50. Maybe you're only going to discount him, you know, 3 rounds or whatnot. But it's really kind of feeling out the vibe on the rest of the room where everybody else thinks he's going to go, because it only takes one guy and then you're not getting your target. And so it's not that you have to be, you know, the absolute high. I mean, well, you do have to be the absolute highest because you got to take him. But I think there is something to kind of feeling out how everybody else feels about the injury as well.
Yeah, I mean, we can do some research and we can kind of see what's going to happen long term, which is a sort of a nicety in this day and age, since information is usually pretty much out there. But you also have to worry about, you know, players are not always, they don't know exactly, they haven't experienced the injury before. So reports that you get that, oh, well, supposedly the rehab is going along just fine, those reports can often change in a big hurry when they start to get more active. The hurdles have not been met yet just because, you know, halfway through the injury recovery seems like it's going good. So it seems like it can kind of be lurking on you as well, which I know I thoroughly don't enjoy doing, you know, or having happen to me while I'm waiting for a fantasy baseball season to start. I also want you to comment, Evan, on another thing that came up in the chat today that you may not have seen. We've got like 4 different chats that we run through FWFB. And I was watching the Washington Nationals game today, and Trey Turner stole a base without even having a throw made. And the announcer said unequivocally that Trey Turner could steal 100 bases this year if his body holds up. So I wanted to know, I've had some pretty lofty ideas in my head and thought that, you know, if everything goes right, maybe he could steal, you know, in that Billy Hamilton range, that 65 to 70, low 70s range. But do you think this 100 stolen base projection, or even the possibility thereof, what are your feelings on that when you heard that?
I'll take the under if I was a gambling man. And I did see this in the chat, and it prompted a really good discussion of where people's expectations of the Nationals lineup is kind of meeting reality as we sit 2 weeks out from opening day. I think if you would have asked anybody, let's say in January when we were doing our team previews, and you would have asked them where you thought Adam Eaton and Trey Turner were going to bat in this lineup, I think 95% of people would have said 1 and 2, and they may have argued over who occupied which spot, but I think there was a lot of thought that Adam Eaton was going to bat lead off, Trey Turner was going to hit 2 in front of Bryce Harper and get awesome pitch selection, and things were just going to be hunky-dory, and we haven't seen that happen. We've been seeing Adam Eaton hitting closer down to the 6th spot in the order. I was talking to a couple other friends about this, and they said that they had heard Dusty had already said that, you know, he'd talked to Eaton about not hitting leadoff, and he wanted Trey going forward. My thought was, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this, is if Adam Eaton did get back in the top of the lineup because, oh, I don't know, Jason Worth is old and he's, you know, might be hurt or hitting 180 come May. If Eaton does hit behind Trey Turner, does that cut into his stolen base opportunities? Do you think it's something Trey can overcome on the way to, you know, 65 stolen bases like you're trying to project for him here?
You know, I think it's really hard to say how it's all going to play out. Obviously, there was people that were playing devil's advocate against Trey Turner when they thought that he was going to hit right in front of Bryce Harper and Daniel Murphy for a couple different reasons. Number one, if you're on base and Bryce Harper is at the plate, you know, it makes it much harder for them to shift the defense and do a lot of other things against Bryce Harper if you stay at first base versus moving to second base. So I understood that part of the argument. I also understood the part of the argument that, you know, people claim that, you know, when Bryce Harper's in a favorable count, you don't exactly want to steal and perhaps get caught when he's about to deposit one into a nearby river or lake somewhere, which is possible when his wonky swing is just right. He'll go on month-long tears. So I get that part of it, but I also don't think you do yourself any favors by setting up a lineup in a way where these people can't use some of their best assets on the field. You know, I think it's a disservice not to give Adam Eaton a chance to steal at least 15 or 20 bases, and it's a disservice to your team to have Trey Turner not be able to steal at least in the high 40s for stolen bases. So, you know, it's always odd with Dusty Baker, is always a manager that we're always trying to really put a finger on, you know, for various reasons, everything from, you know, what he did to, you know, Kerry Wood and Mark Pryor to, you know, what he does to young players versus old players. I mean, it's all come up over time, seemingly in an ongoing stream. But I don't think, I have a hard time imagining that the Nats want to limit how much those guys can run. And that might actually be the impetus for them hoping that they can spread them out somewhat in the lineup. So they're not blocking each other and they're not blocked by who's up to bat when they're on base. So that's kind of how I see it at this moment. Would you agree?
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, like you said, there's two different ways that you can be blocked from stealing a base, right? I mean, there could be somebody on base in front of you, or like you said, Bryce Harper's up and, you know, you don't want to end an inning on a, you know, base running error when you could put, you know, a crooked number on the scoreboard. What I wonder, as you were kind of talking about that out loud, is, so you're saying, you know, okay, Trey may get a little more of the yellow light if you know, Bryce and some of the big boppers are coming up behind him in the lineup. So do you think that he would steal more bases if he was hitting 6th where Eaton was, as opposed to where he may be hitting either 1st or 2nd?
Well, my guts tell me that if he hits 1st and they have a guy like Worth behind him, that he's going to get as much green light as he wants, especially when Worth is at the plate.
Right. But take Jason Worth out of the equation, because I think most everybody else has.
You know, it's always weird with Worth because I remember when that contract was signed and we thought it was going to go much worse than it has. Granted, he's not a great player anymore, but he's probably a better player than we thought he was going to be when this contract started 7 or 8 years ago. But regardless of all that, and this goes into Dusty Baker as well, being incredibly loyal to his veterans. But if you take him out of the equation, I do think there is some residual effect from the two of them batting, you know, right next to each other in the lineup. But again, I just can't, I can't see it. You know, Dusty Baker's, you know, also a guy who is affiliated with the Reds that, you know, have, look at all they've done with Billy Hamilton. So it's hard for me to imagine. I think that I would worry more about steals for Adam Eaton, who's not as good of a steals guy. I think Trey Turner, I think they're going to let Trey Turner run wild. And last year is sort of proof in the pudding because the second half of the year, you know, is running like a wild man. So I think it hurts Adam Eaton a lot more than it hurts Trey Turner, which, of course, was the way that the direction of the conversation went for me, because I think Adam Eaton is a good major league player. I think he's been streaky. I think he's sort of average-ish at everything. And the debate came up that Ben thinks, sees no reason that Trey Turner can't have 150 combined RBIs and runs. And I want to know, or did I say Trey Turner? He thinks that Adam Eaton can have 150 combined runs and RBIs. Do you, would you agree with that? Would you, where would you take the over or the under on 150 RBIs plus runs for Adam Eaton?
Okay, so my thinking when I'm when I sit down to kind of start to posit this number is, A, I think about Jason Worth and how much he sucks, because that's all I can think about when I think of the Nationals. And so, like, if when Worth is, like, done for the season, if he gets hurt or he's, the batting average is awful and Eaton slides back up towards the top of the lineup, like, I think it's going to even out his numbers, right? Because if he's hitting sixth, you're expecting more RBIs than runs. If he moves to the front of the lineup, he's going to get more runs and RBIs. So I think it's going to be pretty even. And, I mean, 75 in each category is pretty decent. I'd probably take the under because it's kind of what he's done in the past, and I don't think the lineup gives him a terrible bump. Like, we've talked about, even going back to the Nationals preview that we did together, like, how high does the ceiling go on Adam Eaton? Like, even if he was to hit leadoff, how many runs was he going to score this year?
Yeah, and I'm going to leave this as an open-ended question to me, because later in the show, I'm going to come back to it when we talk about one of your bold predictions. So we're going to leave the audience hanging there. That's a little tool we know in the trade there, Evan. You into it?
It's called a tease, and as opposed to jumping directly into that, we'll talk about everything else under the sun, and we'll make you wait. So stick around.
There we are. We're using all the tools of the trade right before your eyes and ears. All right. Well, why don't we get started on our main topic discussion of the night? And Evan was the most forthcoming person in a number of bold predictions that he made. I have half as many predictions as he does, which is okay. But Evan, why don't you start at the top and tell us your bold prediction and why you believe in it, and then I will cut into your optimism. How's that?
It's okay that somebody else gets to be the rain cloud every once in a while. But first, I mean, I want to talk about just a couple other, and they've been predictions / bets that we've talked about at other spots on the show. Jim Johnson and under on the 27.5 saves. I know we know where you stand on that. Yeah, last week when we were talking about Mike Moustakas versus Nick Castellanos, did you want any action comparing those two on any play rater or any other criteria you see fit?
I would prefer Moustakas this year, and I might be leaning too heavily towards the gains over a short stretch last year, or I might be leaning too heavily towards the fact that this is his free agent year, so I think he's going to be extra motivated, which I know Justin doesn't like. He thinks players are robots for the most part. You know, they're professionals, so it doesn't matter their situation. I think Moustakas is going to be especially motivated this year. I would take Moustakas, and you could pick the criteria. I guess, you know, I would take, like, Moustakas is definitely going to win at least 3 out of the 5 normal fantasy categories would be my first inkling. You agree?
See, Well, no, my inkling is that you're wrong and that Nick Castellanos is the correct answer, but I don't know that 5x5 categories is the best way to do it, because then you're factoring in steals, which I think for these two specifically is just kind of, you know, a crapshoot. So I think overall player rate or finish would more equally, you know, weight the runs and RBI contributions.
I am absolutely fine with that. I will take Mike Moustakas.
I am in as well. And the one other thing that I had been drinking a little last week, so maybe that was it. But Dansby Swanson against Francisco Lindor in 5x5 categories, if you want to go that route. I'm still taking Dansby, so I don't know if you want to chide me on that any.
You're seriously offering me Francisco Lindor versus Dansby Swanson? I will.
In 5x5 categories, and I'll win three of them.
Okay.
All right.
I would have taken four categories for Lindor, so I'll definitely take three. So, you know, and I hope you're right, because I really like Dansby Swanson, but as of right now, I think he's a much better real-life player than he is fantasy, and it'll be fun to see if he proves me wrong or not as we go forward.
As do I.
Yeah. Now let's get into your man, the Yankee, coming off his 7-home-run campaign. Let's go into Mr. Brett Gardner. What is your fearless prediction for him?
Oh, so, I mean, yeah, I had Brett Gardner as a top 30 outfielder this year, which is half of, you know, what his current NFBC ranking was when I was looking at it. And if you wanted to kind of start this conversation here, because I think it's going to eat up a little bit of our time and actually where we ended up going, so screw us and not following our tees. But I have Dexter Fowler as a top 15 outfielder this year. And there's this big group of players that I'm looking at statistically, like if you look at their projections, and just as I say the name, I want you to think of your gut prediction for these guys across the board. All right, ready? Christian Yelich, Odubel Herrera, Lorenzo Cain, Dexter Fowler, Brett Gardner, and you could probably throw Adam Eaton into this list as well. Now, these are guys that are going insanely high in drafts, like if you look at a Christian Yelich, guys that are going insanely low in drafts if you look at like a Brett Gardner. But I think with all these guys, you're going to find about 15-15 for, you know, home runs and steals. You're going to see a fairly consistent batting average. There are some that do stand out a little more than others here in that area. And then runs and RBI, I mean, you look at the Royals, the Phillies, the Yankees, the Marlins, they're pretty terrible. And then the Cardinals are decent, and the Nationals have an awesome lineup. So say what you will about run and RBI numbers, but I just don't know why there's such a wide variety in how we view this chunk of players, and why you can tell me that Brett Gardner is going to be so much worse than Odubel Herrera in an, you know, I just don't see it. So maybe you can enlighten me a little bit here, Chuck.
Well, I understand the slant that you're coming at this from, because I do think that there's much more of a shelf in the outfield than people realize. And I have Christian Yelich as the last outfielder before the fall off. So I like Yelich probably a little bit more than you do, even though I'm worried about the Marlins in general. But the rest of the outfielders that you mentioned, that Lorenzo Cain group onward, I think there's more question marks than answers on most of those guys. To that extent, I get it. You know, so I agree with your line of thinking for the most part. My questions about Brett Gardner, though, come from a few different areas. Number one, he's 33 years old now, and he managed to hit a lot more grounders in 2016 than he had. So his OBP went up, which you would kind of expect for a guy who runs like he does. His OBP went up, and his home runs dropped, like cut in half, I think, from 16 to 7. You know, his walk rate was also up, 0.5%. So that helped add to the OBP gains as well. And his strikeout rate was down 4%. So some of that is likely, you know, an older player recognizing the strike zone better, et cetera, and so forth. But at the same time, I think it's harder than ever to have a guy that you're not thinking can hit more than the, you know, 12 to 15 area of home runs in the outfield with as much power as there was last year without at least knowing that you're going to get, you know, upwards of 20 to 25, maybe 30 steals from. And I wonder if at 33 years old, it's getting a little harder to count on that from Gardner. And the only other thing I would mention about Gardner is there is some concern about playing time against tough lefty pitchers, which I get to some extent with, you know, Matt Holliday and perhaps Chris Carter gets hot early in the season and pushes for extra playing time in the DH spot. They have Aaron Hicks and some other guys that they have some investment in that they may want to get some at-bats for. So I think that would hurt too in a guy that you're trying to get max out your volume to get, hopefully get at least 15 steals from. So it's not that I hate this prediction. It's that I have some skepticism about betting on a horse that seems like he's a couple steps closer to the pasture instead of on the upside of his performance arc. So, you know, like I said, I hate to cut down your theory because I like your theory in general because I'm not really sure that, you know, that there's a huge difference between – there's not as much of a difference as there is in number of picks for sure between the guys right. that you're speaking of. But if I could move him towards the top of that group – I think I would rather have somebody that was younger that I thought was more likely to have a breakout in one of the categories instead of Gardner. And mentally, and I wish I had a little more time to study this, Gardner's been a guy in recent years that has gone through some real sharp performance spikes. You know, he's had a good month and a half where he looked like he was really performing sort of at all-star levels, and then it was followed by a downturn. So I think you have to be careful in points leagues too, because the last thing you want is a guy that you're counting on for reliability. And I think you're going to get some feast or famine. So why don't you criticize my criticisms there, brother?
I think if you've been listening along to the Tuesday podcast as it's kind of evolved, is I come up with these ideas and Chuck like takes them in and kind of cleans them over, and he's like, okay, this it's good, but let me tell you how I can make it a little bit better. And that's what I love about our conversations and getting to deal with you. I understand what he's what, 33? You're expecting at least 15 steals for him to maintain some semblance of value, especially if the power is going to, not be what we've expected it to be. If you're expecting him to be 15-15, he's got to hit 15 home runs. He can't hit 7 like he did last year. I completely get what you're saying there. But I think the Yankees hate Jacoby Ellsbury, and Gardner will lead off, which in, as being an accumulator, which for a guy that you're getting late and a guy that you're bold predicting to have really good success, I think that's something that you want. It's a no-brainer, and he's been fairly healthy. I mean, the last, since 2010, he's played over 145 games in every season. So factoring in some time off, like you were saying, even if it comes against lefties, I think he can still be a productive bat in the lineup.
Yeah, I would agree with that fully. The other thing I threw around in my head is, there was talk going into the offseason, which this seems to be going on with the Yankees all the time now, that perhaps they would be looking to trade him, which I don't know how possible it is that they could be doing poorly enough during the year that they would trade him. But obviously I think it would be a serious shot to his what power he has if he went to a different park, since the porch in right field in Yankee Stadium is seemingly the most inviting non-Coors Field porch in all of Major League Baseball. So time will tell if that happens or not. If they get a lot out of Pineda and Severino and they're in the wild card chase deep into the season, I think you're going to see Gardner in pinstripes all year for sure.
I know you, those lefties in Yankee Stadium, you just love. And the one thing I was watching in an early spring training game, he's pretty much the most tenured Yankee on a team full of youngsters that, may need a little bit of a clubhouse presence. Like I said, they hate Jacoby Ellsbury and they would never, that's like leaving the kids with the drunk uncle. Like, I don't think the Yankees want to do that. I think having a guy like Gardner around that, you know, they like and see as, you know, he's just kind of like a Mr. Yankee. Like, he's what I think about when I think of the Yankees.
All right, well, it's my job now to cool on your to try and put some ice over the top of your next theory here. And the next guy I want to talk about is your theories about Dexter Fowler, who kind of ties into our conversation and will end my tease about what I want to talk about with Adam Eaton. So why don't you go ahead and tell me about Fowler and why you're so high on him this year?
Yeah, he's putting together fantastic numbers in you know, what spring work we've seen out of him. And I know last week I kind of just threw it out there like, oh, I just want to see him rub it in all of the Cubs' faces. And, you know, I still do want to see that. But I think there is something about, you know, wanting to, you know, kind of show this rivalry a little something. And I think he still does have, you know, quite a bit in the tank as far as playing power, even as he is going to turn 31 here right before opening day. So happy birthday to you, Dexter Fowler, if you're listening to this. But I think you're a lot of the same thing. It's going to be a large a large working of where he's hitting in the lineup, a product, if you will. And, you know, he scored 84 runs last year on a Cubs team. He only played 125 games. But, I mean, I think that's what do you think? 90 – we'll go 95 runs for Dexter Fowler over or under this year.
I think that's about right.
I think that you paused.
I think when you get away from Joe Maddon, you're going to get less time on the bench. And I think he did have little nagging injuries last year as well that we can hope that he avoids since he's an athletic type player. So if I had to, I would take the under, but I would say barely under. I would guess somewhere between 90 and 93, maybe 88 and 93 kind of runs for the season for him. So I don't think we're off base there. I mean, the number that I wanted to point out is the 48 RBIs.
Yeah, I mean, that's bad. And that's a leadoff hitter in the National League, though.
And so that returns, and I really needed Ben here to give him a hard time about this. But when he told me that he thought, you know, that 150 combined RBIs and runs was more than likely for Adam Eaton, when I look at both the season that Dexter Fowler had last year, including he had a 350 BABIP last year, when I look at that season and I add up 84 runs and 48 RBI on a Cubs team that was about as explosive as it could possibly be, so you're only at 132 last year, which, you know, granted, the 125 games is a mitigating factor. I get that much. But I also want to point out something that I think is getting underreported. That's that Matt Holliday might not be the Matt Holliday that you know, that he was when, you know, he was in Colorado or when he just got to St. Louis. But I still think he was a veteran presence in that lineup. You know, it's a lot different than losing David Ortiz. But from a leadership standpoint and from a history of run production standpoint, I think it's getting it's getting looked over that this St. Louis lineup is going to be without Holliday in the middle of it. You know, it puts everybody else in different positions. It makes Matt Carpenter and Stephen Piscotty have to be, you know, major run producers, and makes them try and turn Randall Grichuk into something we haven't seen yet. So I'm not saying that's impossible. I know, you know, Matt Adams is the other guy. Big City, I think, is his nickname. Matt Adams is the other guy. Supposedly, you know, he's a new guy, cut himself in half. He's chiseled compared to what he used to be. But we have never seen really anything either from him. So, you know, if you had told me before I looked at the numbers, boy, was Fowler gonna do better as, you know, a hitter in the St. Louis lineup or in last year's Chicago lineup, I think it would be pretty safe to say that most people would assume that he was going to do better in the Chicago lineup. So, and it's not, like I said, again, it's not that I disagree with your thoughts that he could be a top 15 outfielder. And if he's in an OBP league, I think he gets a ginormous, boost for sure. But he's not really a classic stolen base guy And, you know, he's been pretty up and down in that category for most of his career. And the Cardinals are not a team, you know, largely because they can't get Colton Wong in their lineup. But they're not a team known for stealing bases, you know, since the days when they were beating my Brewers in the 82 World Series. So, you know, I see some hedging here, too. I like Dexter Fowler, but I would push more towards your examples, leading me to believe that there's just a huge muck in the middle of the outfield. And I think people have to be careful. And generally speaking, I think you want to get a couple outfielders on your team whenever you can before you get to this nebulous cloud. Because picking who's going to have good years out of this, you know, Dexter Fowler to Brett Gardner and maybe four or five players beyond Brett Gardner, picking out the right guy in the right situation seems like a very dangerous game. Would you agree with me?
No, totally. And so real quick, I agree. Brett Gardner is just a bold one. And really, I did want to parlay it into a bigger topic that we can hit on real quick. As far as if you wanted to rate the outfield eligible Yankees in order from most productive to least productive, like, is Brett Gardner even your most productive? Like, do you think he has a better season than Holiday or Ellsbury, or you can throw Greg Bird in there if you want to?
I'm really big on a renaissance for Matt Holiday. I've owned him in multiple leagues that I've been in. And matter of fact, I had to hold myself back from drafting him in the league that we drafted together, because otherwise that was going to make a clean sweep. I do still think he's a professional hitter, and I think he has a chance to be a lot healthier mixing in regular DHing. And maybe in my head, you know, they've done this experiment with Carlos Beltran, and relatively speaking, it worked as far as keeping him productive. I like Holiday the most, but I think that puts me in a minority, because Holiday is not going very highly in the drafts that I've seen, and that's part of why I've ended up with him. But after that, I would definitely take Gardner. You know, it's hard to imagine how much Jacoby Ellsbury has gone down, but he's really, really gone down. And I'm not a believer in Aaron Judge. I think the Aaron Hicks is a flag that's flown already. I don't think that ship is going to sail anymore, you know, as far as him being an everyday player by any means. So it would go Holiday and then Gardner for me. But that puts me in the minority. I'll openly say
no,
that.
I know it does. Yeah. Hey, real quick, just while I'm thinking, and I'm thinking about, you know, injury risk mitigating and whatnot, and I know they play different positions. Matt Holiday versus Greg Bird, just 5x5 categories, if you will.
Well, I'm going to take my chances with Greg Bird, even though a closer look at Greg Bird's stats makes you realize that he's not really the purest form of a power hitter. He's more of somebody who, you know, in the minor leagues used the whole field. And so, part of the advantage, huge advantage, is having him. I've heard comparisons of him growing into a John Olerud type hitter. That's how well the control of the strike zone was in the minors. So I would take Bird and Bird's potential upside over that of Holiday, but they're right next to each other for me. I like them both a great deal.
Yeah, I was thinking as kind of like a late round util guy, like if you had to choose just one. So, does that kind of end the blah outfielder talk that we have lined up? Or?
Well, we probably have to switch to a different subject. We'll switch to my first bold prediction.
Yep.
And you certainly will have multiple levels that you can attack this at. But my bold prediction is that Addison Russell will finish as a top five shortstop by the end of the year. Go ahead, Evan. Start ripping away.
Oh, I you didn't want to plead your case first, or?
Well, I can plead my case.
Go
for
it.
The last above double A, his batting averages really didn't show any signs. Since he actually grew up a little bit. Those last 2 years in the minors, he hit .333, .294, and .318 in double A or above. He had really healthy walk rates in the minors the whole way, which sort of mimics or mirrors the growth that we saw to a 9.2% walk rate last year. The question going in to his professional career was if Addison Russell was going to hit for any power, and now he's done that. And so the chances of him being very good in every category and falling into a handful of steals enough to make him a very high-end guy in the middle of a great lineup, I think it's a bold prediction, and I think it takes some of the top shortstops having bad years, which I think is a little more possible than we've accounted for. You know, I think Trevor Story is a guy that, you know, people have raised red flags about. But even Xander Bogaerts before last year, he had a strong second half push. There was some questions about if he was going to be able to put full years together. So, but it will take a lot to get him to the top five, and maybe that's overly ambitious. But I do think he's getting massively underdrafted. How about you?
Well, I think it's really interesting because we've talked about the kind of shortstop run and where it boxes off. Kind of, you look at Correa, Seager, VR, Bogaerts, Lindor, Story, and then you throw in guys like Gene Segura, Trey Turner qualifies there as well. I mean, that's more than five. So, I mean, you got to knock somebody out of there, and injuries will do that. I mean, we know how much I hate Francisco Lindor. So, I mean, obviously he's gone. VR, I think, is you've talked about him being a high variance guy that you don't like paying the high price for. But it's when you say top five, I mean, you kind of have to – if you think about like the ESPN player rater formula, I don't know that his power that he shows, which is great for a shortstop, outweighs the speed that some of these other guys throw and what that does for their value. I mean, we were talking, and Eugenio Suarez is going to show up later in this conversation for sure, based on one of my bold predictions. But you take a look at, you know, even just the third base pool on the player rater and how much Hernan Perez got a bump from, you know, the amount of steals that he put in relative to the field. I think that's something that could be a roadblock in your Addison Russell love, but I do love the walk rate he's shown. I just wish the average would come up just a little bit. I'm not saying he's got to hit 275 or anything crazy like that, but damn, I'd love to see him hit 260 because I think it would do a lot for his other across-the-board numbers as well.
Well, the projection systems have him more as a 250-style hitter this year, which, of course, I always think it's harder for the projection systems to go off young players and account for growth. It seems like they have to use some past, they have to lean heavily towards past major league statistics when they do some of these projections, which I appreciate looking at, and I do think is a useful tool in the mix. But of course, the idea is that in experienced drafts, you're going to have almost everybody going off projections of some kind or another.
Right.
And so the key turns out to be trying to figure out who is going to actually exceed those projections and who has the best chance to do so, which is not an easy thing to do at all. To avoid going back to an outfielder too quick, why don't we have our Eugenio Suarez conversation now, my friend?
I mean, since we, brought it up or whatnot, completely inadvertently and not planned at all, I was having a conversation about Alex Bregman with some people, and basically we were talking about Bregman wants to have the season that Eugenio Suarez just had, like as far as going 20 home runs, 10 steals. I think, you know, me projecting him as a top 12 third baseman is factoring in some of that inflation that he could see in the third base rankings because of his stolen base totals. I mean, like I said, Hernan Perez last year was 4 standard deviations better than the average third baseman as far as steals were concerned, and it floated him to be a number 13 third baseman on the Raider last year. Now, Suarez isn't going to steal as many bases as Perez did by any stretch of the imagination, but I think if he does take a step up even just a little bit in the home run categories, if he takes even just a step up a little bit in, you know, some of the counting statistics, because I do think he will have a better lineup around him, and I just think that he's a young guy. He's got a lot of room to grow. And me and you were talking before we hopped on the mic. He was a guy that we both thought really highly of last year and didn't quite have the second half that we were expecting.
Yeah, when I looked at the stats, I was expecting him to look significantly worse in the second half. And his batting average actually improved. But, you know, his home run rate went down a touch. And I think there was some bottoming out months towards the end of the first half that got him off a lot of people's radars. But when you look at the numbers in the second half, they say they support your theory that he's being widely underrated. If he could hit 270 in the second half, which was really his first full year in the bigs, you got to think to yourself, boy, if you could get a guy, if he could bring his average for the season up into the 270s with his draft position and his draft stock being so low, I've got to believe that you're going to see a heck of a draft value there that I would not have without diving deeper into his statistics. I would not have thought that. And of course, you know, he fits the other things that I like to talk about as well. You know, if you're looking for guys that are going to break out, he's going into his age 26 season and he hits in, you know, arguably the second most friendly park to hit in the entire National League. Somewhere, you know, it's right around Miller Park. It's not Coors Field, obviously. Might not be the Diamondbacks either, their field in Phoenix. But it's probably pretty close. It's in that 2-4 range for best parks that you could possibly hit in. The unfortunate thing for me is I don't really prefer what they're doing with their lineup. As far as, I'm not certain that I see much upside in many of their hitters, even though I think Joey Votto is the prototypical great professional hitter in the game right now. Besides that, I don't see a lot to get excited about. I think there's going to be heavy doses of Tucker Barnhart this year, which would be hard for, most anyone to swallow, and growing pains with Peraza. And Adam Duvall looked like two different guys in the two halves last year. He's probably the poster child for, home run derby regression at this point. There's a lot of things have to fall right for the counting numbers to be okay for him. And so, that limits it a little bit. But the ballpark and the fact that he's off everyone's radar seems like if you can get him as in a reserve slot in a normal 12 or 14 draft at the end and sort of take your chances, I think there's a lot to be gained here. So I'm grateful that you pointed out and had me look closer at Suarez's numbers because I didn't realize at all how much better they were last year than I thought.
So and that's because we owed him.
I want to say one more thing about third base. Is third base has a better chance at regression candidates than shortstop does because, Adrian Beltre is going into his age 54 season. I believe he's 53 right now, so he's going to be 54. Which is pretty amazing. And how often can you go down on one knee and hit home runs when you're in your
mid-50s? All the time if you're Adrian Beltre.
when you're in your mid-50s. I'm not rooting for it. I love Adrian Beltre as far as being somebody who wants to play every day, etc. But I think there's a possible regression there. I think we've warned people about regression possibilities with Hernan Perez. And I think third base is a lot less stable. You know, Evan Longoria had a rare spike last year, but we haven't known from year to year exactly what we were going to get there. So as far as of your bold predictions, this is a prediction that I think has the best chance to actually happen. Because a little bit of a positive step from a 25-year-old who's showing good signs and regression from a number of candidates. You know, like you said, that's Alex Bregman. He's not getting, you don't exactly know what you're going to get. You're still dealing with small sample sizes there. It's a lot easier to come up with four or five people that could regress at the top of the third base pool than it is at shortstop. So it's a prediction I like the most.
Right. And first of all, I want to clarify, I'm not saying that I'm taking Suarez over Bregman. I'm just saying that, like, people want to try and pin a number on what they think Bregman's going to do. I think starting with what Eugenio Suarez did last year with probably be a good start for him, even though we're expecting more. B, while we're talking about Suarez, and we're like, well, I didn't realize that he had such a decent year that he did. Well, that's because he was absolutely terrible in May and June, and then kicked it back on in August. And if you had Eugenio Suarez on a deep league team, you didn't care about August. So that's why a lot of people don't remember how good he was.
No, I think we're free to go back to an outfielder before we talk about a pitcher after that.
Yeah, and, let's do it.
My outfielder to talk about should be right up Evan's alley. I promote Braves on this podcast, and Evan, the Braves fan, cuts them down. That's just this is an ongoing pattern that we have. It was really odd because when I read all the recaps and all the scouting reports that I could read on Matt Kemp, I found very little optimism. But I also like to think that there's a nerd-based stat bias that sort of happens in this day and age from time to time. And I think that Matt Kemp is getting that nerd-based stat bias right now, more so than I can remember a player in a long time. Meaning, you know, they talk about him being a drain on batting average. Well, I think a .268 batting average is probably around league average last year. So I don't really consider him, well, he wasn't a positive in that category, and if you have the player rater in front of you still, you'll be able to tell me. I don't really think he was all that negative of value in batting average. And that was with a .297 BABIP, which is quite a bit below his career norms. So, you know, he had 197 combined runs and RBIs with 35 home runs. And his numbers as a Brave were even better. You know, he had a .280 batting average with 12 home runs, 39 RBIs, and, you know, 56 games with the Braves. And from the outside, you could make the argument that he was never really excited about going to San Diego, and he didn't really seem to click there for him, despite the fact that it was, you know, close in locale to where he had been in L.A. And it seems like the move to Atlanta has really rejuvenated him, because following the season, we had news that he's in the best shape that he's been in a long time, which perhaps will make his outfielding a little bit more palpable or, you know, sufferable at least than the complaints that it's drawn in recent years. But I think that Matt Kemp is the Albert Pujols of the outfield. I think he is getting underrated, and I think people are not realizing this sort of happiness bump that he can get, and I think he's matured more than we're giving him credit for, and he realizes that that he needs to cherish these moments while he can still be a productive player as he's getting into his 30s. So what do you think about my crazy prediction that Matt Kemp will be a top 15 outfielder this year?
Okay, so there was a lot to digest and a lot of what just happened, so I may be asking you for some re-ups there. Matt Kemp, you look at the outfield player rater, and in batting average, he was actually a positive contributor, not by a full standard deviation from the average, but half of a deviation, so he didn't kill you. I think there is a lot that people like to talk about Matt Kemp not taking a walk, and that's because it's there. But he actually took more walks in less games as a Brave than he did in more games as a Padre last year. And I know that you can't teach an old dog new tricks and small sample size and blah, blah, blah. But meh. It happened. Like, that's a statistic. It's something I'm keeping an eye on for sure. He hasn't had a fantastic spring, but the one thing that they love about this guy down in Atlanta is that he hits in prime real estate behind Freddie Freeman. He really helped Freddie have a fantastic season that he did last year, and he is... I don't know why people think he's just going to fall off and not be, you know... 30 home. I think 30 is a bold prediction, and even just throwing that number out kind of makes me squeam a little bit. But if I put it at 26 and a half home runs, what do you think for Matt Kemp's power? He hit 35 last year, by the way.
Yeah, I don't have any idea why you wouldn't take the over there. I mean, there's some fear of how the new park is going to play. I get that to a certain extent. But by dimension-wise, it should be a better park to hit in than Turner Field was. You know, when we've learned in recent years that you can't just use dimensions for this.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Kemp is a pull-heavy right-handed hitter, and from what I've seen from SunTrust Stadium, is they're not affecting the fences so much in left field. It's more the right field fences that are being brought in and made higher. So I don't know how much it affects Kemp, but I mean, even still, Freddie doesn't seem to have any issues with it. So.
Yeah, I would definitely take the over on 26 home runs. I would be rather stunned if he doesn't hit at least 30, which may be ambitious, but.
But I heard, you know, Werner and I believe it was Matt on one of the outfield shows, and they were talking about Kemp, and they were just kind of just taking the piss out of him, and I was getting a little offended for Matt Kemp, you know. But I think Kemp's primed for a pretty decent year. Granted, he stays on the field, and granted, the Braves lineup in front of him stays on the field, which you can say that about every team, but I don't get the hate on Matt Kemp.
Well, I was wondering from a purely statistical analysis exactly what the percentage of Matt Kemp haters are that wish that they had sex with Rihanna instead of Matt Kemp. Is there a statistic base for that?
Well, a small sample size. I just pulled everybody in the room over here, but it's 100% over here, Chuck. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I think he's got a really bad reputation from what happened in Los Angeles in general. And the other irony is when you talked about him and regression is that he is literally he was in that super tight rookie of the year race with Ryan Braun, and you don't hear as much fear of regression in Ryan Braun, who's going, 70 picks higher than Matt Kemp is, sometimes more than that. So I do agree with you that I think he's getting wrongfully hounded here. You know, the 519 slugging he had as a Brave last year in 56 mm-hmm. games. I think there's a little bit of a Carlos Gomez type factor here, where I think all the signs are pointing to the fact that he's pretty content in Atlanta. And he certainly never seemed to be all that content in San Diego. And part of that was that, A.J. Preller was acquiring players and then unloading them a few months later, left and right. And I think there was always a swirling storm of when he was going to get shipped out of town again. So he didn't feel like a building block of a team, where the Braves have really staked their claim to Matt Kemp. And I think it seems like he appreciates it. And as you get older, sometimes that happens. Talented guys don't always use all their talent right away. Nelson Cruz, now of the Mariners, that was once a Brewer, by the way. Don't think I'm not bitter about that, is definitely exhibit A thereof. So my bold prediction is Matt Kemp as a top 15 outfielder. Really anywhere within the top 25 would make him a draft day steal. So if he gets anywhere as close to 15, let alone in the top 15, I think people will be very happy with the returns they get from Matt Kemp, who is not going anywhere. They are riding him right in the middle of that Braves lineup, the newly rebuilt Braves lineup, as it were.
Do you remember when Matt Kemp almost went 40-40? Isn't that great?
Yeah, and that's when he was a center fielder and people thought he could play center field, which seems like almost even more of a distant memory, since now every time I hear his name, it's nothing but a battering of his poor defensive play. So anyway, yeah. Moving on from my Matt Kemp prediction, let's talk about a guy that's really interested me. I was sad to see that one of my league mates kept him in one of my leagues because I was going to target him. Let's talk about Masahiro Tanaka, who, I've heard the buzz that he looks really great this spring, and he's had some dominant outings. So you believe that Masahiro Tanaka can win the American League Cy Young this year. Why don't you give us your spiel? Why don't you give us your spiel for that?
I do, and I know he doesn't have, eye-popping strikeout numbers, but his ratios are ridiculous. I know everybody's worried about this elbow issue, and believe me, I am too. But once again, I don't think that we can predict that it's going to be this year. He pitched 100, pitched one out shy of 200 innings last year when everybody was having these same concerns, and I know that that mileage is tacked on when you look at it, but I think at the discount that he's going, if you take a look at some of the pitchers he's being drafted behind, is kind of silly. And I didn't do a ton of research. We were kind of spitballing today, but did he get Cy Young votes last year? I feel like that might have been an area that he may have actually collected some love. He's going as the 20th starting pitcher off boards right now, behind guys like Kyle Hendricks. I'd rather have Tanaka. David Price, I know this is before the injury, so you can kind of throw that in there. Cole Hamels, I know people love to hate on Cole Hamels, Chuck. would you take Tanaka or Cole Hamels?
I would much rather have Tanaka.
Well, let me go up the list and see where the line is for you, if you will. Carlos Martinez.
Oh, wow. Razor close. Yeah. Right now I would take Tanaka, but only because I would flip a coin on a regular basis, but I have shares in Carlos Martinez already, and I like to have shares in as many players as I like as possible. But right. it's that close.
Jacob deGrom, who's also been getting some phenomenal spring reports.
I can't put him ahead of deGrom. That one, okay. I would rather have deGrom.
Do you put him ahead of Kyle Hendricks like I did?
I think he's got a lot more upside than Hendricks does. Again, I think that's a staff, how I've built my staff kind of question. Because to me, you have to assume that there's some accelerated risk with just pitching in Yankee Stadium versus pitching in the in the National League in the Wrigley Field, which when the wind is blowing in, the second coming of Glenn Allen Hill combined with Reggie Jackson can't get the ball out of the park. So some of that is weather-related luck. But at the same time, I think Hendricks has got a really high floor for a pitcher of his type. So if I needed upside, I'd go Tanaka. If I felt like I had some pretty good starters already, I would probably go with Hendricks.
Okay, understandable. The other names before we hit like top 10, area would be like Carlos Carrasco, Steven Strasburg, and Chris Archer. Two of those three I have well-documented thoughts by you and Carrasco and Strasburg. Where are you at on Archer? I don't know that I've heard a ton about him this offseason from you.
Well, he's always been one of my favorite players, but last year was the first year that I had serious stock in him. And for whatever reason, he had all those struggles. There was a lot of struggles, and it was impossible for him to win games. I believe his struggles were on the road. The road splits were terrible, I believe, for all of the Rays starters last year. And so I want to say that I would rather have Archer just because of the massive, strikeout numbers, and because he doesn't pitch all of his games in Yankee Stadium, even though Tampa wasn't a great place to pitch last year either.
Yeah.
So I would rather have Archer. I'll be surprised in one of my remaining drafts if I do not get any if I don't get any shares of Chris Archer, because I do like him. By the way, Masahiro Tanaka was 7th in the Cy Young voting for the American League last year.
So maybe not necessarily a bold prediction, but I mean, I think that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he's getting discounted a lot for this, whatever you want to call it, in his elbow. How would you describe it? Because I describe it as a time bomb, which I think a lot of people see it as such.
I don't think that's really as accurate as it's getting put. The thing about the slight, he's got a slight strain of his UCL joint, which always scares people because it's got the UCL joint in the name. But his poster child, or the person that he most wants to mimic, is that years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, Irvin Santana was given the exact same prognosis and decided to pitch through it. And it held people, there was a red flag around him for the first over 3 years that he had the injury. And now I think, we're going to start getting to that point by the end of this year, if that time bomb doesn't blow up, that we're going to start thinking that there's no reason to think that his time bomb is any different than any other pitcher's time bomb.
Right.
So I have a tendency to agree with you. I did have shares of Tanaka last year in some of my leagues. So I'm a believer in in Tanaka's upside. I just am not. I still have some reservations about pitching in that stadium, even though he's pitched really quite well there. So it's probably it's not exactly deserved when I say that. But he's been a good investment for the Yankees. Can you imagine how bad their staff would be without him?
No, they'd be awful.
Yeah. So I mean, he's a guy that I think is getting overlooked in drafts. So I like your take on Tanaka. I really do.
Yeah, and I mean, sub-4 ERAs at Yankee Stadium, three seasons that he's done that, so that's phenomenal. Last year, 234 on the road for Tanaka, which was phenomenal. And by the way, I was also looking up Chris Archer's stats while you were talking, because I have the attention span of a squirrel. And do you happen to know what Chris Archer's away ERA was last year?
If my memory serves me correctly, it's horrible. It's approaching 6.
Yeah, 5.5. Yep. After a 3.5 in 2015, a 2.78 in 2014, and another 3.5 in 2013. So
there was predictions last year, or people wondering if the Rays were going to get investigated for the fact that their pitchers' home stats were wildly above their road stats. Almost pure ridiculousness for, you know, how Odorizzi was pitching, every pitcher right on down the line. And, you know, you'd expect that a little bit more with Blake Snell or somebody young like that. But guys like Odorizzi and Archer that are veterans, you would think they would be able to handle road tilts quite a bit better than they did last year. So, you know, and most people have stayed pretty high on Archer, and a lot of it comes down to that incredible strikeout rate that he had last year that draws people in. And he's also been pretty durable for a little guy. he's got the little guy stirrup socks on, he's been a likable international ambassador. So I think those things help. Whereas for some reason, Matt Kemp kind of got booed out of LA and now everybody hates him. It seems like Chris Archer gets quite a bit more leeway. Chris Archer and Marcus Stroman, by the way, who's in, you know, all the MLB Tonight commercials, it seems like he's been given a lot of leeway too with people, despite the fact that his performance after his rookie year hasn't really warranted it. So there's other people that seem to mirror this same phenomenon that we're talking about right now. I think we kind of went through our bold predictions. You feel like we have, because I've got an off-the-wall subject that I'd like to throw at you.
Hot two-minute take, because the last one that I had was Freddie Freeman not hitting 25 home runs this year, which if he's being taken inside the top 30, you want him to do. You want him to hit more than 25 home runs. Last year he hit 34. I believe his previous career high was 23 or 24. I'm pulling up his page right now. I had a talk with some people before last year where I didn't think Freddie Freeman was ever going to hit 30 home runs, and now that's just what people seem to expect him to do. So, if I was doing an over-under bet, I would maybe want to build in a couple more there, maybe go 26.5 or something like that. But I just don't know. Even as much as people want to pretend that they, we don't know about SunTrust or whatever, like, I think it's still going to be under 25.
Well, the odd thing is that he's a player that's proven that he can be pretty productive at the major league level without hitting 25 home runs.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I think some of that, I think people draft him sort of knowing that there's quite a bit of downside in that home run number, meaning that they wouldn't be surprised with anything between, 20 and 24. I think people would be kind of surprised now if he didn't hit at least 20. But the incredible discipline that he's shown around the plate, you know, with the 400 OBPs and 386 and 384, I think that sort of has tempered people's concerns about him. Sort of, it's odd because the swing plane is so different and everything is so different about their games in different ways, but it's kind of like a Joey Votto thing where he seems to be getting that kind of respect, that he's just a good, sound player that has a relatively high floor, so people are taking him perhaps a few spots higher than they should. But to me, in an OBP league, like I took him, what would have been insanely early in a batting average league. You know, I took him with my second pick in the staff league, and I did that because I didn't want to get trapped at first base, and because I thought he was pretty much a guarantee to have a 375 plus OBP.
So, right. No, you know, I'm in a startup dynasty draft that does the OBP and slug thing, and I had the first overall pick. I took Trout, and then I took Joey Votto and Freddie Freeman with my second and third round picks, and then I needed to change my pants for the rest of the draft because I was so shocked that he fell that far in an OBP draft.
The Joey Votto one surprises me even as...
It was a startup dynasty, yeah. So I understand the age thing and whatnot, but I kind of went for a win-now mentality.
Well, you should know this by heart. My gut tells me that, what, Freddie Freeman is 27, 28? Or is he older than that?
No, he's 27.
Oh, so I mean, in a dynasty league, that you could make an argument that he's got more years in front of him than a Votto does.
Yeah.
But you know, Votto at the same time has proven that he can have stretches of time where he'll carry an offense, Edwin Encarnacion style, which I'm not exactly sure we've seen the purest form of that from Freddie Freeman. We've seen hotter months, but not that, you know, ridiculous 18-20 home run month.
No.
That we've seen some other players, you know, and Votto get crazy hot like he did the second half of last year. So I don't necessarily disagree with your prediction. I still take the over just because I'm trying to be an optimist for my team.
I will be
relatively stunned if he hits 30, but I'm hopeful that he hits more than 25.
Okay. Well, take me off the wall. Sorry that I had to throw that in there to talk about my man crush. And it's a man crush on Freddie Freeman. Like, this is legit. But take me off the wall a little bit. What did you want to talk?
Well, anyway, I had this commissioner thing, which I recently heard saw a tweet stating that being the commissioner of a baseball league is like being a babysitter without getting paid. Which at times certainly seems like it is. But part of my babysitting gig, if you will, recently was coming up with a price list for players.
Okay.
That we're going to use because we keep a certain amount of players, and otherwise we do half draft and half auction. It's kind of a hybrid.
I love that format. By the way, you mentioned that on another podcast, and I did that one year, and I'm all behind that.
Okay, so we came up with I found a price list. And this price list has some really curious pricing things on it, and I want your gut instinct. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this price list included their projections for what they thought the players were going to do.
Right.
More so than just the idea of it being a price list off what they did last year.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these I thought you would really like. And so let me throw these off you.
With no keepers or anything like that. This is just standard draft values.
This is what these players will have to be drafted by for the first 11 rounds of our draft. They can be drafted at this
cost.
So
they're projected for your league after keepers. Gotcha.
Yes. So, okay. You know, if they're being kept, you can't keep them or whatever. But I like this one, an especially large amount. They have Junior Guerra of the Brewers, who's been announced as a starter. You know, the opening day starter.
Yeah.
They have him at $6, and they have Zach Greinke at $4. How much would you rather have Zach Greinke than Junior Guerra?
It's by a decent amount, I'd say. I don't know how bold you want me to get with this prediction, but a safe amount. We'll go there.
Okay, well, you know, there's other pitchers up the ladder that they obviously like a lot. Like, you know, I could have gone... They have Zach Greinke for $4 and Jameson Taillon for $17. I could have done that comparison instead. But instead of doing that, I will I'll change modes a little bit on you, and I'll mention that they have Keon Broxton as a $23 player.
Okay.
And they have Daniel Murphy as a $15 player.
Wow. Okay, so that makes me wonder how much they're valuing the steals. And the one I'm hung up on the Zach Greinke thing. Like, is it just based on like last year's numbers or what? Like, that seems crazy to me because I agree Greinke had a terrible year last year, but I think even if you run those same projections off of any other year minus his 2010, I think that price is at least double.
Yeah, I was at least. It was, I mean, I started with the shocker. That was the most shocking price that I saw on the list because my eyes jumped out of my skull when I saw that he was only a $4 player. I think Guile alone, and by the way, recent reports have his velocity coming back in the spring, which he's not always been a guy who started out with his best velocity. So on Guile alone, I actually think he's like an $11 or $12 pitcher on Guile alone. Regardless, you know, and that would be if he pitched in Coors Field, I wouldn't be afraid to pay, you know, $10 for him. So $4 to me means that he should go in the first round of our draft, especially since we can keep players off of this value going forward. And the only reason we had to use this price list is because the draft kit didn't come out, the free draft kit that ESPN always used to have. Mm-hmm. It didn't come out in time for us to use it.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I had to search for another one that was going to be, you know, obviously free and very available for everyone. So
that's nuts. Where did they have Zach Davies at, huh? I love Guerra that much.
I'm not sure that Zach Davies is on the list. Another quirk of this is that it goes into negative values.
So, that's kind of my thinking on Greinke too, was if they were just thinking he's going to suck that much in Arizona that they were projecting some sort of negative value for his team, which in all fairness, Guerra probably provides for your team as well.
Well, I think the thing about Guerra is that he was very, very good when he pitched last year. My wife and I were joking around that, you know, that Zach Greinke, you know, just doesn't have the kind of career accolades that Junior Guerra has because, you know, Zach Greinke never pitched in the Venezuelan League. You know, he never pitched in the Korean League. You know, so internationally, maybe they're giving him points for his international play.
Quite possible.
You know, and independent ball. I mean, yeah. Junior Guerra, of course, was the very first player ever acquired by our new GM, Mr. Stearns. So when he goes out there and even eats up innings, you know, it's pretty crazy that how well he's doing. Another one that I liked, another pitcher comparison I wanted to give you is Danny Duffy for $7 and Dallas Keuchel for $15.
I mean, I get the Duffy stuff, and I get it, but I'm wondering if the price isn't getting a little too out of control for him this year. Am I wrong on that?
No, I think that the hype train has gotten pretty high, which obviously we're coming at this from a different stance because to me, I can't fathom getting him for just $7. but as a generality, you have to take him as your like number three starter, in some cases your number two starter, if you're going to get him in drafts. So you know what I mean? We're talking about something, two completely different things. I'm willing to take a $7 gamble on Danny Duffy. That doesn't mean I want to take him, you know, as a top 90 player off the board.
Which is what you have to do.
Yeah. So I get where you're coming from. And they have players like Pineda and Eichhoff are more expensive than Danny Duffy.
Is it a quality starts league? Because I've noticed that I've been running the custom rankings on some other types of leagues, and if you're in a quality starts league, they seem to love Pineda as far as the projections are concerned.
See, and I don't really understand that because, I mean, I guess when he's good, he's going to be really good, and it's going to be no problem with the quality starts. But I worry about dramatic big blowouts from – that's what I really worry about the most from him. So, you know – I don't know. I wouldn't project him to be all that much better in a quality start league personally. You know, but I guess I haven't looked into it. Maybe he was really good in quality starts last year and I didn't realize it since I don't play in a lot of quality start leagues.
No, he wasn't. I was just trying to pull that up and see why it was like that. He had, from the leaderboard I'm looking at, he had 11 quality starts last year, which is 72nd in the league, right behind Wade Miley. So that tells you everything you need to know.
Well, I don't think we're important enough to have huge copyright things, so I'm just going to say that this pricing system is available on RotoChamp is the name of it, RotoChamp.com. And and it says right on it that their projections are, you know, are involved in it. Another one I really like is Miguel Sano for $2.
Yeah.
I think he had some stumbling, I think it's going to be hard for him as a third baseman and an outfielder not to have a pretty good return on a $2 investment. So it's going to make for a very interesting draft. drafting off of this list. And some of the higher players, just to put it in reference, I mean, you know, Mike Trout is a $46 player on here, you know, and Goldschmidt's 42 and stuff like that.
I would have expected those numbers to be way higher from the numbers you were giving me earlier.
Well, and then, you know, they have Trey Turner for $38. They have him as the eighth highest price player off the board, so they're obviously buying a little bit of Kool-Aid there, which is kind of interesting because some of the other younger players seem like they're
Turner at 38, Trout at 46, and what was the other number you gave me?
Well, Goldschmidt was 42.
42.
Yeah, I have Jonathan VR for 34. I guess Chris Bryant at 32 seems like a relative bargain on this list.
Wow,
is he $14 worse than Trout? I don't know.
There's got to be something to do with the speed that's playing in here that I'm not wrapping my brain around, but that's just me thinking on the fly, which is not good for anybody involved.
Well, your ADD perhaps will make you go to this website and try and figure out what's going on.
At least we both agree that the ADD is there. So, yeah.
Well, anyway, I think we had a very good and pretty expansive conversation about a number of players, and we hope we helped add to your preparation for your drafts that are coming up. We hope you do great, and we hope that you rely on FWFB during the season to provide you with constant updates. And part of our job is going to be forecasting players this year that you want to pick up ahead of time before other people start nabbing them off of the fab wires, which is part of this podcast that I'm really looking forward to. And it's been great to work with Evan so far. So throw out your Twitter handle one more time, and then I'll do the same, and we'll get out of people's hair for today.
At EasyEv3, and while I would love some Twitter love, and you know, showing that you guys are into the season and looking for some questions, a rate and review is probably about the best thing that you could do for us. And if you know, we bring any joy to your week whatsoever, highly recommend taking a few minutes out of your day. We take, you know, at least an hour to sit down and record, plus research and whatnot. It helps us do what we do and do more of it. So I'll leave it there, and thank you for being you, Chuck, and having this conversation with me.
Well, you know, me being me, you know, obviously you're a different human being, kind of human being, because you seem to enjoy having to work with me, which I appreciate. Although Darius and Justin seem to stomach it pretty well on the other podcast as well, as does Ben.
Not the first time I've been called a different human being. I'm sure you can believe that. But I was thinking, so, you know, we've kind of joked around about doing a longer form podcast. And me and Chuck are actually going to catch a Brew Crew game at some point this summer. You think we should just bring the mics to the ballpark and have like a 3.5 hour talk while we sit and get drunk and watch the Brewers?
It would be interesting to chart exactly how well we did for, you know, listens for that podcast.
Both because
of the length, and because we could put, you know, we could advertise it with some sort of sudsy beverage, etc. As we were doing it. So, but that is something I'm definitely looking forward to, getting to meet you this summer, and getting to meet Darius are two of the things that I'm really looking forward to within what we do. And you know, thanks to everybody on the FWFB staff for all that they do, and please appreciate us via a review, like Evan points to, and we'll get a nice, solid stream of good information out there for you all year. That's definitely what our goal is. You can reach me at Just Chucking It on Twitter. I take questions. I take feedback. There's a lot of great listeners out there. And, you know, join our Facebook page, too. Like us on Facebook, and you'll see there's a lot of good stuff going on there. So for FWFB, this is episode number 240-something, early 240s, I think maybe even 240 or 241. And we'll talk to you again next week. Same bad time, same bad channel. Thanks, everyone.